Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Mr. Gilroy himself, Al Gagliardi. He has lived in Gilroy, California for almost his entire life, the last 74 years there with his lovely wife, Betty. But he never would have met her if he didn't make it home from service in the Army during World War II. One of his brothers did not make it home. That was the reality so many American families were dealing with all those years ago. Let's hear the story of how Al ended up in the Army after graduating from Gilroy High School in 1942.
I was drafted. I graduated, and I got a job. Wages in days was like 15 cents an hour. I got a job first over here at Gentry's, and got maybe 70 or 80 cents an hour. Whoa, boy, big money. And then I said, gee, I'm going to, a friend of mine said, let's go to San Francisco. Get a job there, $1 an hour, easy. So we did, went to National Biscuit Company and got a job. We coming home on the weekend with $50 or so. Everybody was, oh boy. And I was only in there, that position, I probably went in about December, and about February, they drafted me. Here I was making $50 a week and got drafted for $21 a month. Yeah, we didn't get much money, but we were confident, and we were, I don't know if you want to call us brave or not, but we were of the nature that we're going to kick your butt, and we did.
Where did they send you?
To the Aleutians.
Did you have to train at, like, Camp Roberts or something first, or somewhere like that?
Well, that's where basic training was. Yeah. But then you were sent to your regular outfit, and I was sent to 10th Mountain Division, see, and they came here to Fort Ord, and we trained for mountain warfare, because that's what we were doing. And we went for the first campaign, well, the second, Attu. We fought Attu there first. And then we went there for Kiska. We were fortunate. Kiska was supposed to be, you know, my brother told my mother, just don't have too much hope, see, not going to make it.
So your brother knows that this is supposed to be heavily defended by the Japanese, and he's telling your mother, Al doesn't have much of a chance.
Right. And so we went up there, and we were to attack Kiska. We got there, and apparently what happened was we come up in the south of the islands, and they were on the north. You know, it was rough country, and the water was rough. Jesus, I did some guard duty there, and holy cats. You had to hang on by your teeth. Apparently, we come up in the south section, and here they are in the north. But by the time we get there, you know, it took quite a while, they were doing a lot of bombarding and shooting. So we had to pull back on the south side to refuel and rearm, fire all our ammunition. And when we did that, it took about a day, you know. Yeah, it was a big job. When we went to go out, well, they had already rearmed and everything, and they were on their way back to Japan. Well, they had too big of a start on us. We couldn't catch them. We had to just not go. So maybe we were fortunate, but I thought we could have licked them. So that was it. We took the islands, and everything was ours. So it was good, because that was the first U.S. possession that they took. I mean, that were our possessions, not like the Philippines. The Lucians were ours. They belonged to us. And so we were proud that we prevented them from taking our fleet from the northern part, because they could have done great harm for us, you know. Well, the Canadians, they joined us because it was their land too. So we had a good force, because, you know, Japan had come a long ways. But once we chased them out of there, they never came back, because, you know, we had too much fleet there and too much air power, and they were too far away, and they couldn't have made it. When we attacked it, we had to bring the fleet from South Pacific up. Well, it was quite a ways.
But you didn't stay with the 10th Mountain Division. What happened there?
Well, the 10th Mountain Division wasn't going to stay there. They were just attacking there, and they were pulled back to go to Italy, see. Of course, I come back with them to Colorado, and we had enough, you know, people to hold it. We had some battle wagons and stuff. Then we had to prepare for tough war. So they didn't come back right away. We came back to Pacific Coast, to Monterey, to rearm and to prepare for fight. But I don't think they were powerful enough to do it. They wanted to do, you know, they did a lot of things up there, all the way to Australia almost. They didn't have a big of a navy or army, so they had to take care of what they could, and we got powerful and powerful.
So what caused you to separate from the 10th Mountain Division?
Well, what happened was the 10th Mountain, we came back, and they separated us. Gee, I hated it. I felt like they kicked me out of the 10th Mountain Division. But what they did, and I asked one of the officers later on how it happened. I said, gee, I was dedicated to the 10th. And he said, we did it by every 10th man was kicked out. And you stay, you don't. And me and my best friend, George Berman, were young punk kids, you know, wore our hats backwards and everything. And he stayed and I didn't. So I lost my spot during it. I wanted to go to Europe. I wanted to go to Italy during it.
Yeah, and they would end up in a lot of fighting in Italy, in the mountains there.
Some of the guys told me that they were looking down on them from the mountains, you know. They just didn't have a chance.
So who did you end up with? Where did they reassign you?
Somehow I got to the 147. They sent me back to the Pacific. I was down in New Caledonia because that's where, how far they had pushed us all the way to Australia and all that. So after a while, the Marines had already landed on that first big battle that was there for so goddamn long.
I think you're talking about Guadalcanal, right? Yeah, Guadalcanal, where the 147th Regiment had seen action before you joined that outfit.
The army came in that was there, and Japanese weren't able to take it until we got strong enough to kick them out of there. Once we broke their code, they were screwed. We broke their code, and we knew exactly where they were and what they were doing and everything else. They lost so many ships there, they were dead. And it was just because we broke their code and knew exactly where they were. In the Battle of Midway, boy, we killed them. They were dead. They lost ships that they should have never lost. They were in no fight for us then. We just had to push on through.
And so what about you personally? So you'd gone up to Kiska, but you guys take that island without a fight. And now that you get transferred, what was your first real taste of combat with your new unit?
Well, we stayed there at New Caledonia for quite a while because that's where all the reserves, all the main force went to New Caledonia. And Nimitz was there. He had his headquarters there, and MacArthur was, of course, right in Australia. So that's where they started from. So just, you know, pushed north island by island. You know, one, you'd hit one area. Once you hit Battle of Midway, I mean, we hurt them bad.
Eventually, you would end up on, I know, Iwo Jima and Okinawa, right?
Right, yeah.
There aren't too many guys still with us who can tell us what this was like, what you experienced on those islands, what the conditions were like, what you had to endure. What are some of the things that stand out for you about your time in those battles?
Well, I don't know. It just seemed to me they were battle with a battle, and everybody pulled all their weight they could.
And were you in a rifle platoon?
Yeah, I was a rifle platoon.
So you probably did a little shooting, and you probably got shot at.
Yeah, they missed me.
Well, good thing, because there's a lot of kids and grandkids and great-grandkids who wouldn't be here if they didn't miss you. Are there some close calls that stand out in your mind, some moments where they came pretty close to you?
Well, yeah. I think when we got the Bronze Star, I was lucky, and that's why I say I thought I should have got a higher medal, but saved a bunch of lives. Somehow I found out about their objective. That's why I got the Bronze Star. I was able to give the information to General, and we kicked their butt, and they didn't get away with that.
So you came up with some strategically valuable information. Was that from a prisoner or from the enemy somehow? Or
no, I think it was just observation from what we were doing. They were mustering their forces for some pretty big push there, and I got the information to my commanding officer, and so apparently he had enough pull to get enough force to kick him out.
So if you hadn't have come across that information, more Americans might have been killed because you wouldn't have known where they were coming from?
Yeah, probably. We were in a spot where we were going to get hit pretty hard, and we just outfoxed them, that's all.
You know, a lot's been written and said about Iwo Jima, and I've heard a lot of people, you know, talk about how short the battle should have been and how long it turned into. And another piece of that legend, if you will, is the tunnels that the Japanese had on that island. Tell me how you figured that out.
Well, they had so many tunnels you couldn't figure out how many. Complete bottomless. Some were three stories down, you know. And I never got in one of those tunnels. You'd never make it, you'd be dead. The only thing that saved us from them is they had no supply. They had no water, they had no food. And they had to steal the food from us to make it. And, you know, we were watching the best we could. They were at a disadvantage. They had no hope. I don't know how they managed to last as long as they did, because they just had no food. And they had to steal, you know, which they could do. Nighttime, they stole here and water there. There was no water, and stole food for guys. I felt sorry for them, but, I mean, they were on the other side. I can only feel so sorry, and tough luck. I know, I remember we captured one guy, well, way up north, only 5 miles. And they knew a place to where they would surrender. It was down by where we were, south, by Suribachi. It was off there to the left, about 4 miles, not very far. And so we had one guy, Japanese. He was docile and wasn't going to cause any problem. And I was a machine gunner, so I only had a .45. I didn't have to worry about a rifle. So they told me, you take him down at jail. So I put him on the left side, and I had the .45 here. He was docile. He followed me. Couldn't talk to him, but walked this way, that way. We'd gone about 4 miles or more, and we got near Mount Suribachi. And that's where our outfit was, our regiment was located. Mm-hmm. That's where we were situated in there. We were going through our area where we bivouacked and stayed. We had just put up a new kitchen, like, where we could cook. Otherwise, you had to eat, you know, crap, kerosene. And we were coming near that, and I had this guy with me. Couldn't talk to him, so I think we walked in the little place they made the kitchen like and everything, the concert hut. And he went and got 2 plates, and he got 2 filling full of food. Well, hey, this guy never ate for God knows how long. And we sat down and ate some food there, you know. Boy, he just about licked that plate, you know, poor guy. And when we got through, I put the plates back. We only had to walk from here past the street there away quite a ways. They opened the gate, and, you know, they saw I had a prisoner. Okay, and yeah, it's pretty mild. He said, thank you. Because most guys would have killed him. You know how guys are. They think it's bad. It's okay. It's an enemy. Kill him. And they knew I wouldn't do that. I had to have reason. Everything was judged by the Geneva Convention. And he got in there and they closed the gate and said, thank you. That was it.
I can tell that little thank you and the gesture with his hands to signify it, that sounds like that still means something to you all these years later.
Yep. You got to respect the rules and regulations. Geneva Convention covers it all. After all, you know, he's just another guy. He's fighting for his country. I'm fighting for mine. We don't have to be savages. Just do what you have to do.
And there was more that Al Gagliardi would have to do in World War II, including a burden that is hard for anyone to explain. His family became a Gold Star family when one of his brothers was killed during World War II. Much more to come with this soon-to-be 98-year-old veteran of World War II when we come back. You can find photos of Al and his brothers during the war and see what he looks like now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.